Court of the State of Hawaii, now we can be.
Please call the case.
Case number SDWC 12794, Dave B. Studia, arguing for petitioner William H. Jameson Jr., arguing for respondent Brandon H. Ito, argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, Mr. Jameson and Mr. Ito. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right, Mr. Jameson, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a warning light come on at that point in your argument. Mr. Ito, we will give you a warning with 2 minutes left to go. Mr. Jameson, please proceed.
May it please the court. It is just basic law that before the results of a scientifically-based instrument test can be admitted into evidence, there has to be a sufficient showing that the instrument in question was working properly. We submit that the ICA erred when it agreed with the court below that a sufficient foundation was laid. The reason we say that is because what the record reflects is that in attempting to lay the proper foundation, the prosecutor in this case relied upon the testimony of the criminalist Gene Ardiente. Gene Ardiente testified that the particular FTIR that was used here was in proper working condition essentially because of what was contained in, in a printout that was generated by an inbuilt validation test that was part of the instrument in question. And objections.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Jameson, but while you're on that point, would your position be different if the printout had been available, the printout had been submitted?
If the printout had been submitted.
Excuse me, CJ.
Oh, I'm sorry. You need to speak into the mic. We can't hear, and then we're also recording what's said here today. Thank you, Mr. Jameson.
No, I would still object, even if the printout had been submitted, because I think that there's a lot of information lacking that would. It's difficult to trust the results of the printout, given what was missing in this case. We know that the printout is a result of a manufacturer-generated procedure. But the problem I have with that printout is we don't know exactly what the procedure consisted of. She just said that there was a procedure. Now, if you contrast to what she said about the analytic balance, she said it's simply pressing a button. We don't know how you do, how you do the performance check for the FTIR itself. We don't know how complicated it is or how easy it is. We don't know if proper procedures were followed. We don't know if the person who ran that procedures was in fact qualified to run that test. So for those reasons, I would submit that even if it was present in this case, even if it was admitted into evidence, I would still object that it did not lay the proper foundation.
Now, what about the ICA's observation that this appears to be very similar to the process that was done in the Mineva case, and it thought that that case was almost dispositive in concluding that there was a proper foundation laid? What's your response to that?
My response to that is that it is similar, and it's troubling, because I think that in Mineva, what I think Mineva needs to be clarified on is this: what is the procedure designed to do? The fact that it comes from the manufacturer, I think, is significant because it goes to the reliability of the test itself. But the procedure, however, is designed to place into the hands of, or into the mind, I should say, of the criminalist information that tells the criminalist something the criminalist would not otherwise know, namely that this particular instrument is working properly. So the fact that there's a procedure in place in and of itself does not necessarily lay the proper foundation. It's what the procedure gives you that lays the foundation. And in this particular case, what the procedure purported to do was place into the mind of the criminalist certain data that allowed the criminalist to say this thing in fact is working properly. So if you eliminate that, if that information was inadmissible, as I think it was because it clearly was hearsay, then you have no foundation in this case.
In Manewa, didn't the analysis apply the personal knowledge requirement to both tests? In other words, to the balance test, what the judge said, or what the court, this court said, And this was, I guess this is a discussion also of the Wallace case. Now, one thing that I found a little bit striking, did the ICA case ever even mention Wallace, the Wallace case?
Right now, I'm drawing a blank, I don't know. But if I can come back to what you said. Okay, the fact that two instruments involved and the personal knowledge you're talking about. My understanding of Maneva, when it came to the analytic balance, what the expert there said was that he had, in fact, run a performance check. The problem with the performance check that he ran, however, was that it did not come from the manufacturer. So even though he said, I had information based on the, what do you call that, the performance check I ran, that check was not admissible because it didn't come from the manufacturer. It had to come from the manufacturer in that case. What that left him with was basically a situation was with whether or not there was information in the, let's say, a business record, for example, that would have contained the information that he needed. Okay, so he has really no personal knowledge in Maneva that the balance is working. He doesn't have that knowledge. He's if you eliminate what he relied on, and you have to eliminate what he relied on, the method that he used, because the method was, I would assume, deemed not to be valid. Because where did that method come from? There was no evidence that method came from the manufacturer. So you take that out, what else do you have to establish that the analytic balance was working properly? So I don't know about this personal knowledge thing there. There just was no information from which he could conclude that the analytic balance was working properly. But in the other, the GCMS, what I think they were saying is that, look, there is a method for the GCMS that does come from the manufacturer. But that, I'm assuming that they're saying that that method gave him information that this particular instrument was working properly, and he had personal knowledge about that information. So he wasn't guessing like in Wallace. In Wallace, the criminalist was guessing that the representative who came to the lab once or twice a year, in fact, was qualified and, in fact, calibrated the machine. In Maneva, he wasn't guessing that the machine had been calibrated. He knew it had been calibrated based on what he knew about the procedure and based on what he knew about what the procedure was designed to tell him.
In this case, isn't it a self-calibrating machine? I mean, if the machine is calibrated, can't you assume that it was the manufacturer who put in the procedures to calibrate the machine?
Yeah, there's no question in here the procedures came from the manufacturer. What we don't know is just how do you go about calibrating this machine with the software that the manufacturer gave to you? Do you just press a button and you do that? It's relatively easy, I assume. But we know nothing about that. That's part of the problem in this case. We don't know how complicated the validation procedures are. We don't know if you need specialized training. And importantly in this case, because the expert in this case did not run the test herself, we don't know if the person who did run the test knew how to run that test. So I think that's why, the case is so different from my case. You know, what basically my case comes down to is this, okay? All we want to know, we just want to know if this particular FTIR was working properly. We need to know that. It's basic law. How can we know that if I'm a criminalist and I don't know how to calibrate this thing myself, I don't know if it's working properly just by looking at it, and there's no expert there to tell me. The expert, what I can do is let me put it this way. When the representative comes down and calibrates this machine and ensures that it's working properly, it's really clear that he's not going to be back for several months. Now, during that time frame, there has to be a way to tell whether or not the machine stops working properly. So what the manufacturer does for that contingency is design a program built into the machine itself, or the instrument itself, I should say. And that test can tell you if it's working properly. The test can do that. But how does the test do that? It generates data on a printout that you are taught to interpret, and from that you can tell it's working properly.
So is your position that the witness who testified here could have provided the proper foundation if she went into more detail about what the test was? Because perhaps she is the first one in the office some days and actually runs the test. Would that be sufficient for her to come in and say, our practice or policy in our office is to do the following things, and because of my knowledge and expertise, I can tell you that when those things are done, this is the nature of the test that's performed by whoever comes in first in the morning. Would that be sufficient in your view?
I think, you know, thinking about the, I hope I'm saying the name right, State versus Aide. Aide was a purely mechanical test. This one, I think, is software. I think that if she said all of those things and said that she obtained that knowledge from the manufacturer, then yes, I think it would be. I think it would be. But of course, that didn't happen. And if she said that, you know, I attend the classes and that's where I learned all of this information from, and we know it came from the manufacturer, I think she would have, that would have shown that this thing was working.
I want to backtrack just a matter of curiosity. You know, when you started practicing like 30-something years ago, was a machine like the FTIR even in existence?
I don't know. I really don't. 30 years ago when I started practicing, I think I was a district court, family court. And
I'm just curious. I mean, when these machines started coming into use and how these cases were proven before these machines came into use, and whether or not we stopped at the, you know, the crystal test, the scientists actually looking at things under the microscope and saying, yes, this is what it is, because that did happen here, right?
Yeah. You know, I'm just guessing, but because of what it does, I would think that this test is a relatively new development, I would think, because my understanding is that you put the substance on, under the microscope, and it makes it dance, it makes the molecules dance, and it prints this thing out, and you compare like a fingerprint. That's pretty high tech to me, you know. I mean, it's not just, it's different, I think. But, you know, my position coming back to my case is this. You know, if you was to exclude the Ms. Arriente's testimony about the contents of the printout, if you were to do that, you know, and you should have, I think it should have been done, because I think he clearly was here, so it was offered for the truth of the matter asserted, and there was no attempt to try and introduce it as a business record, which I think it might have come in that way. But if you were to do that in this case, where would the foundation be that this thing was working properly? She couldn't tell you without that information. She needed that information. Take out the information, and you ask her, without the information, can you tell if it's working properly? She'd have to say, no, I can't. I can't tell just by looking at the machine. And I think there's two reasons to have excluded this particular her testimony on this issue, aside from the fact that it was hearsay. There was a clear violation of Rule 1002. You know, what was being used to prove that this thing was working properly? The contents of the printout. Okay. When that is the case, Rule 1002 is very clear for good reason. If you're going to say it's the printout that tells you that it's working properly, you can bring it out. Introduce the printout. The state flat out said, we're not going to do that. The record does reflect that after the state did say that, defense counsel did point out that they need to produce the printout as part of the foundation. So if you violate both of those rules, why do you need to comply with those rules? Have the court done the right thing and sustained the objection? You are left in a situation without a foundation. And that's simply what our position is.
Well, could I interrupt you at that point, Mr. Jameson? Because let's assume that you're correct, that the results should have been excluded. This is a distribution case. Why wouldn't the Schofield plate case apply in the sense that it's not really necessary to prove that this is actually methamphetamine and prove the content of the drug, because it's the intent that is at issue here?
Yeah, I'm troubled by that because I guess It wasn't that long ago when I was doing trials.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
It wasn't that long ago when I was doing trials. And what I can, I cannot imagine a scenario where the state fails to prove that the substance in question is crystal methamphetamine, and that case even getting to the jury. You know, even if the defense is procuring agent. Because the elements of the charge are that you distributed crystal methamphetamine. If the prosecutor were to say to the judge, Your Honor, I'm not bringing in proof that this thing is crystal methamphetamine because I don't have to. The defense here is procuring agent defense. I think the judge would say, well, thank you, but I'm going to grant the motion for judgment of acquittal because you haven't proved an essential element.
Well, I know you're an experienced trial attorney, and if you think through the scenarios where you have an undercover agent who is in communication with a defendant that says, I'd like to purchase, fill in the blank, methamphetamine, heroin, or what have you, and take steps in order to complete that transaction, might that be an example of a distribution case where there isn't a need to actually prove that there was a specific drug involved? I mean, this, I think that's sort of the scenario that was in Schofield.
Well, if that is the case, there's something wrong. Because you're charged with distributing crystal methamphetamine. If you go to somebody on the street and they say, sure, I will pick up clear in this case. I'll just say this. I mean, people rip each other off all the time on the street. You can sell white crystalline substance and not know what you're looking at. You know, so the mere fact that there's an agreement to buy crystal clear, otherwise known as crystal meth, and that, you know, a transaction takes place and this white crystalline substance changes hands, in my mind, does not establish that you have trafficking crystal methamphetamine. You traffic in a clear white crystalline substance.
Well, that the holding in Schofield was, this is 63 Hawaii at 81, chemical analysis of the substance would not be required because the crime was complete where, with specific intent to sell, the accused has offered to sell the contraband. So, I understand your hesitation, but let's just assume in this case that there was substantial evidence to support a conviction, even if the results are excluded. Nonetheless, the question remains, would this error be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? In other words, would the fact that these results were admitted during the course of the trial mean that the error in this case was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
My position, my understanding, is the error in this case is not harmless, far from being harmless, because if you cannot show that this thing is crystal meth, then what have you got? What have you got if you can't show it's crystal meth? You know, if you are charged with trafficking in crystal methamphetamine and you don't raise the procuring agent defense, I don't see much of a distinction that just because you're raising the crystal, the procuring agent defense, therefore you don't have to prove it's crystal meth. I mean, what the law is designed to do is to stop you from trafficking in this poison called crystal meth. If you're dealing in something else, I mean, you're not violating the law.
Well, I mean, as you know, the law often is creating a sanction for a certain intent. So just to have the criminal intent would be sufficient to qualify for commission of the crime. So, but the fact remains that there still has to be a determination whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And what I understand you to be saying is that given the fact this evidence did come in, then it was evidence that the trier of fact could have considered in determining whether or not there was an intent to distribute the crystal meth, and therefore would not be harmless. That's your position.
I must be missing something. Could you repeat that? Because what I'm hearing is the evidence. You're saying if the evidence had
come in. I'm saying if in this case the error was to admit.
Okay, to admit it.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. My position is what you said. If the error was to admit it, right. And I'd like to also, point out that, if there's a case that this is like, I suppose it's closest to the Fitzwater case. And Fitzwater is something like this. In Fitzwater, what was the evidence that the laser gun was working properly? It was contained in the a speed check card. Okay. Take the speed check card out, there was no evidence. This case is like that. The evidence that this thing is working properly is contained in the printout. Take that out, as it should have been, there is no evidence. So as far as whether or not, what did the ICA do that was that merited a cert in this case? to me, what the ICA did was ignore just basic rules of evidence.
They ignored Wallace, it looks like to me.
In a sense, ignored. Yeah, well, they did ignore Wallace. Because Wallace required a foundation, right?
It required a foundation of personal knowledge, both to the balance and the FTIR, and it certainly didn't set up a different requirement for a different device, which it seems that's what the ICA is saying. Manewa, apparently, their interpretation of Manewa is that there's no personal knowledge requirement for the device in question.
It was confusing in Manewa because also they gave the impression in Manewa that the problem really was that the procedure that he used his own weights to determine whether this thing was working. And they said, the procedure you're relying on, it didn't come from the manufacturer. It's like that other, what case was that? Was that Asaye? I'm trying to remember the name of the case where the officer did four things to determine whether the thing was working properly, but his problem was that where did it come from? At least in Manewa, the expert said, it didn't come from the manufacturer in Manewa. That was the problem. But as you pointed out, one of the problems with Manewa is it looks like there's two different tests, one for the analytic balance and one for the, GCMS or...
I'd say that's what the ICA is.
That's what it looks like.
No, I don't, to me, I mean, it's, when I read it, what the Manewa case said was, look, as to the first test, he clearly didn't have personal knowledge, and then as to the second one, they pointed to his answer on cross-examination where Muhammad said, I do have personal knowledge because. And then the court concludes that statement was consistent with, quote, the personal knowledge necessary to establish the GCMSs were in proper working condition. And what the ICA did in this case was just to not apply the personal knowledge requirement.
Well, yeah, because if you look what happened, right? I keep coming back to the printout. Where would the personal knowledge come from? Knowledge of what's in the printout. If you don't have that, then you don't have personal knowledge. I mean, unless I'm looking at it wrong, but that's the way I see it. So the personal knowledge requirement that's mandated by Manewa did not exist in this case. Anyway, I don't know how much time I've used.
How much time is remaining?
7 minutes.
7 minutes to go.
How many minutes?
2 minutes.
Oh, 2 minutes. Could I keep those 2 minutes?
You can keep, if you'd like to stop now, you can retain those minutes for your rebuttal.
Well, I'll just wrap it up really quickly. Well, just let me say real quickly. Again, I just point out, the results should not have come in for the FTIR because the printout should have been excluded. Fit without question should have been excluded. Exclude that printout, you don't have a foundation. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jameson. Mr. Ito.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, where do we begin? I guess I'll begin first by pointing out that the witness that testified in this case was qualified as an expert in the identification of crystal, in identifying substances such as crystal methamphetamine. Qualified as such, certain rules of evidence apply to her testimony, which includes Rule of Evidence 703, entitled Basis of Opinion of an Expert. The first sentence in particular states that the facts or data in the particular case upon which an expert bases an opinion or inference may be those perceived by or made known to the expert at or before the hearing. It goes on to say in the second sentence, if of a type reasonably relied upon by experts in the particular field in forming opinions or inferences upon the subject, the facts or data need not be admissible in evidence. When it comes to the personal knowledge requirement that Maneva spoke of, in view of Rule 703, I think it is sufficient for the criminalist to testify, as she did in this case, that she perceived, she saw the results of the printout, and based on her perception of what she saw, and based on her training and experience, particularly from the manufacturer and in-house training, that it was her understanding, based on her expertise, that FTIR machine was operating properly, in accordance with manufacturer specifications, which is what her testimony was. Now, as far as the hearsay rule and the best evidence rule are concerned, first of all, I think those two arguments are waived because they're being made for the first time in this application for cert. And second of all, even if this court were to consider the merits of those two arguments, I don't think either rule applies here because, again, the criminalist in this case was qualified as an expert.
And how does that distinguish this case from Maneva, where there appears to be the court appeared to emphasize the personal knowledge of the witness with regard to the GC test?
Well, to the extent that Maneva could be further clarified in the context of the rules of evidence, then perhaps. Otherwise, I think it's consistent to the extent that he had personal knowledge that the GCMS was operating properly.
Well, clearly, what about the other test to which evidently he did not so testify?
The analytical balance.
I'm sorry?
The analytical balance?
Yes.
The analytical balance, as far as my understanding of the Maneva case, is that the manufacturer's representative authored certificates pertaining to the proper functioning of the analytical balance, rather than testify in court about its proper functioning. My understanding of the Maneva opinion is that this court held that that manufacturer's certificate was hearsay and should have been admitted.
Is that a subject matter is that information that's subject to an expert's area of expertise insofar as whether a machine is working properly? I mean, is she really testifying, or Ardiente, whether, I don't know, as a man or woman, testifying as an expert that it was working properly?
I think she's testifying that through her training and experience that she was trained to understand how this machine worked, and how to run the self-check test. She was trained to interpret the results of the self-check test to ensure that the results of the self-check test reflect that the FTIR machine she was using was operating properly.
Well, could you follow that thought up, Mr. Ito? Then what do you identify in the record to suggest that Ardiente knew that this particular machine, the analytical balance, was working properly?
I think that
we know Ardiente did not test the machine, right?
Yes, she did not.
Okay, and so help me with that. I think you're suggesting that as an expert, she can rely upon information that's provided to her that might be hearsay. But in any case, what would you describe as the evidence that she was relying upon when she determined that the analytical balance was working properly?
The printout that was produced by the software program. She said her testimony was, quote, according to the printout provided by the computer, it was working, it was in proper working condition. That's at page 68 of the June 13th transcript.
How is that different from Wallace then, which we said was not a good way, because that a good way to determine the accuracy of the weighing machine, because in that case, the expert testified that the machine was calibrated by somebody else and that, the, as I recall, it was a scale, was accurate, but it was calibrated by somebody else, and we said that wasn't sufficient. So how is this different from Wallace?
I'm not really clear about Wallace, but at least in this case, this expert testified that based on what she saw in the printout, the FTIR machine was operating properly.
Mr. Ito, let's assume that it was error for the results of the test to be admitted into evidence, and therefore you're left with a record that is bare of evidence of whether there was actually crystal meth involved. Would that mean that you have insufficient evidence at that time to support a conviction?
No, because the defendant admitted that the substance he in fact had in his hands and handed to the undercover officer was in fact methamphetamine. And quite frankly, I think that admission, at least in case on other jurisdictions, moots any argument on the field contesting the state's evidence that it did not prove.
All right, well, let's assume then you would have substantial evidence to support the verdict in this case. Moving on to the question about whether this was harmless error, I think that Mr. Jameson was making the point that when you consider the evidence before the trier of fact and include this error, the evidence that should not have been before the trier of fact, they may have considered that in determining the question of intent, and therefore the error wasn't harmless, if you follow me. So I guess the question is, is it your position that the error was harmless, despite the fact that the trier of fact could have considered the results of this test in determining whether there was an intent to distribute methamphetamine?
Assuming arguendo there is error, then yes, it is harmless because of that admission.
And the admission does what? It proves the item?
He admitted that the substance was methamphetamine.
And that shows it's I mean, in other words, well, why even have a test result? Under your theory, why do you even need it? I mean, is that enough to prove somebody's either possessing or selling a drug because somebody says that's what the drug is?
When a defendant takes the stand at trial, his credibility is judged the same as any other witness. And for the purposes
of... Well, the jury I believe the jury didn't believe him. His theory didn't go.
That he was working on behalf of as an agent for the buyer, yes.
So, but it didn't fly, so the jury disbelieved him.
Well, the testimony at trial was that he did not dispute that the drug that he in fact had in his hands and handed to the undercover officer was in fact methamphetamine. And if I may briefly address your point about what the state's evidence shows, I mean, in State versus Pudiquet, PUDIQUT, this court, the ICA observed that, quote, it is well settled that when the defense presents evidence after a motion for a judgment of acquittal made at the close of the prosecution's case, any error by the trial court in the denial of the motion is waived by the defense.
But this isn't a situation where we're evaluating whether there's substantial evidence. If the evidence was improperly admitted, we use a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard. This has nothing to do with a motion for judgment of acquittal.
Well,
can I ask you something else? I think I heard you argue that the defense waived a couple of arguments by not previously raising them.
Yes.
Have you, you know, you opened up with arguing about that this was admitted under 702 or something. Have you made that argument before?
Well, I cited to Minerva, and I think Minerva cited to, was relying on 702 and 703.
So you can cite to a case, and if that case has that theory.
Well, I was, my answering brief argued that there was perhaps a distinction between the analysis of GCMS and...
Is that rule ever mentioned in the brief?
No. Any further questions?
Nothing further. If nothing further from you, Mr. Ito, we'll move forward to Mr. Jameson's rebuttal.
Thank you.
Well, while it's, I guess, still sort of fresh in the course of this argument, did you want to respond to the point that seems to be important one that Mr. Ito was making, that you have the defendant admitting that he had crystal meth? So what? Why wouldn't this be harmless?
Because his admission, I submit, does not prove that this was crystal meth. It doesn't prove it. He's not qualified to just look at it and say it's crystal meth. In fact, he may not have known it was crystal meth. Under the facts as I understand them, he went to somebody else who gave him the white crystalline substance, and he may have thought it was crystal meth, but there's a difference between thinking something is crystal meth and something actually being crystal meth. So his testimony that, okay, I sold him clear, and so it was crystal meth, doesn't prove it's crystal meth at all. But I just wanted to briefly, respectfully point out to my colleague that he pointed out, and I think I can understand why, that we waived the hearsay objection. We didn't raise those objections below, and we didn't raise 1002 below. But I think if you look at the trial below, they're both in there. There's no doubt they're in there. And they're in the reply brief. Now, with 1002, it's a little troubling because the defense attorney didn't say, objection, Your Honor, rule 1002, violation of best evidence. But the context in which it is raised, where the state just said, we're not going to introduce the printout, the response is, that's part of the foundation, I think is enough to bring to the court's attention that the printout had to be produced. On the other hand, the state's assertion that 703 is not raised is a little different, because not only is it not in the brief, it's not below either, and you don't see any argument that suggests bringing to the court's attention, Your Honor, you should overrule the objection because the expert, in fact, is entitled to rely on hearsay. And along those lines, let's say that 703 was not waived. Let's say it wasn't waived. Then I think we move into the area of, Haile Fields, because we know that this is introduced for the truth of the matter asserted. That we know. Okay?
How, when you say this, you're talking about the results of the test.
Yeah, the printout. The printout is introduced to prove that this thing is working. Now, the only way to effectively cross-examine the expert on that is, in fact, to confront the expert with the printout. It's a little odd in that what you're asking to be produced is not a live person. You're asking for it to be produced, instead of a live person, a document. But that document has thoughts, information contained on it that could be used to test the truth of what the expert is saying. If the expert is saying that this thing that I looked at, I initialed it, maybe she didn't initial it. If certain data had to be on that printout and it wasn't there, you could confront her and point out that if it had to be there and it wasn't there, then maybe this thing is not working properly. So if you're going to say that the court, that the hearsay rule does not apply, then I think we have a confrontation problem. Then you need to produce at least the printout so you can effectively cross-examine the person who is there. And again, that printout has some reliability problems, if you think about it. Not maybe in just because it's a printable, because of the